Blog Talk Radio.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Welcome, friends, brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, and seekers of the truth. But whoever you are, I know that we all share one thing in common. Don't we not want to know the truth? The truth about what's really going on here in this crazy, crazy world. So welcome to the 583rd edition of SDG, Sola Dea Gloria. And we're broadcasting this live on Christmas Eve, folks. And the title of this message is 2022 Endgame Update Number 48. And a bit later in this message, folks, we're going to tie it all into how to love life in the midst of all this world's chaos and confusion. You know, the Bible says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, "For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile." So I hope you stay tuned to learn four simple truths. Simple but not necessarily easy steps to love life in this lost and fallen world. Now here they are. 1. Watch your mouth. 2. Do good, not evil. 3. Seek and pursue peace. And finally, number 4. Trust God as you keep on praying. Like I said, four simple yet not necessarily easy steps. But the bottom line, folks, is that as believers, we may be in this world, but we're not of this world. We're just God's people passing through. So let's all refuse to be destroyed by this Luciferian all-out war on humanity. And stay tuned to find out the latest news that the lying mainstream media will never tell you as we dive deeper and deeper into America's new 9/11 events, which are unfolding in slow motion while on steroids. But remember, it all started with this lab-engineered, media-manipulated coronavirus heist. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with something from last week. Now, you know, over the past month or so, I've been taking a little flack on how much I've focused on the topic of those two forbidden words, the Jews. And along with Kanye West and the entire bee's nest of controversy that's all around it. But folks, I'm telling you, this is extremely important. I can't stress that enough, folks. This is the pinnacle of conspiracy. This is the bottom line of everything. The reason being is that these very same people who fomented the French Revolution, that toppled the monarchy in France, the same people behind the Bolshevik Revolution that destroyed Tsarist Russia and the Romanov family, the same people who murdered tens of millions of people in the Ukraine during the Holodrama, the same people that created Nazi Germany and this entire Holocaust narrative, the same people behind Operation Paperclip, the very same people still pulling the strings behind the scenes today, they are the very same people currently trying to silence everyone and anyone to shine the light of truth on this controversial and very sensitive topic known as the Jews. And I'm going to call them out right now. They're the Illuminati, known as the Sabbateans or the Frankists. Call them whatever you want, folks. That they're using this anti-Semitism narrative to silence the truth. And remember, I'm going to make a disclaimer here, folks. I am neither a racist nor an anti-Semite, and I do not support Hitler. But I'm telling you, folks, we're being lied to. And it's so important that we understand these truths. And unless we do, folks, we're never going to really get out of this mess. So these very same people who did everything I just enumerated sent a very subtle message this week through the New York Times, perhaps seen only by those of us who have spiritual eyes and light to see. This week in the New York Times crossword puzzle, they published a crossword puzzle shaped like a perfect swastika.
What? Are you seriously? Are you serious?
Are you serious?
Can I have some more coffee?
You know, Paul, I am serious. I am as serious as the 0-degree temperature reading I'm getting on the thermometer out of my window right now. This is the hard, cold truth, Paul, right in our faces. Folks, just look at my podcast banner on BTR, and you'll see the New York Times crossword puzzle shaped as a perfect swastika. Now, just last week in Ken's Corner, I shared with you a book review titled Secret Societies and Subversive Movements. I think it is. I always confuse it. Sometimes I say organizations, but I think it's movements. They're named Nesta Webster. Now, Nesta's been labeled an anti-Semite for her excellent research. And what I'd like to now is have two of my AI friends named Nancy and Matthew read the preface to Nancy's book. But before we do, let's just say hi to Nancy and Matthew and thank them for reading for me today. Hey, guys.
Hi, bro, Ken. I'm Matthew, and it's great to be here. Nesta Webster's book titled Secret Societies and Subversive Movements is a must-read.
Hi, bro, Ken. Nancy here, and yes, Matthew is a must-read. In fact, H.G. Wells, author of so many books, including The Common Sense of War and Peace, said, "In my book, The Fate of Homo Sapiens, I drew attention to the influence of Mrs. Nesta Webster's Secret Societies and Subversive Movements. It is a book that all serious people interested in the British situation ought to read and think about, and very few of them do. I believe her influence spread far beyond the circle of her actual readers."
Now, her influence has gone beyond, because about 30 years ago I read her book, folks. And I am telling you, it's essential reading for today if you want to understand what's going on. So what I'm going to do now, and this is a rather long clip, we'll just listen along and see how it goes. And I'm going to advise you right now, folks, to get out a pen and paper and take notes. And here's what I'm going to implore you to do. Critically think. Don't trust me. Don't trust Nesta Webster. Write down some of the names and some of the references in this preface. It's 17 minutes long, folks. But please, pay attention, this is crucial. Write down some of these names and some of these notes. Go out on the archive.org. Call up these old books, these old dusty books that no one reads, and see if what I'm saying isn't true. So here we go. With no further ado, let's listen to Nesta Webster's preface to Secret Societies and Subversive Movements. This is read by the AI buddies of mine, Nancy and Matthew.
Preface, Nesta Webster. It is a matter of some regret to me that I have been so far unable to continue the series of studies on the French Revolution, of which the Chevalier de Boufflers and the French Revolution, a study in democracy, formed the first two volumes. But the state of the world at the end of the Great War seemed to demand an inquiry into the present phase of the revolutionary movement, hence my attempt to follow its course up to modern times in world revolution. And now, before returning to that first cataclysm, I have felt impelled to devote one more book to the revolution as a whole by going this time further back into the past and attempting to trace its origins from the first century of the Christian era. For it is only by taking a general survey of the movement that it is possible to understand the causes of any particular phase of its existence. The French Revolution did not arise merely out of conditions or ideas peculiar to the 18th century, nor the Bolshevist Revolution out of political and social conditions in Russia or the teaching of Karl Marx. Both these explosions were produced by forces which, making use of popular suffering and discontent, had long been gathering strength for an onslaught not only on Christianity, but on all social and moral order. It is of immense significance to notice with what resentment this point of view is met in certain quarters. When I first began to write on revolution, a well-known London publisher said to me, "Remember that if you take an anti-revolutionary line, you will have the whole literary world against you." This appeared to me extraordinary. Why should the literary world sympathize with a movement which from the French Revolution onwards has always been directed against literature, art, and science, and has openly proclaimed its aim to exalt the manual workers over the intelligentsia? Writers must be proscribed as the most dangerous enemies of the people, said Robespierre. His colleague Dumas said all clever men should be guillotined. The system of persecution against men of talents was organized. They cried out in the sections of Paris, Beware of that man, for he has written a book. One, precisely the same policy has been followed in Russia. Under moderate socialism in Germany, the professors, not the people, are starving in garrets. Yet the whole press of our country is permeated with subversive influences. Not merely in partisan works, but in manuals of history or literature for use in schools, Burke is reproached for warning us against the French Revolution, and Carlyle's panegyric is applauded. And whilst every slip on the part of an anti-revolutionary writer is seized on by the critics and held up as an example of the whole, the most glaring errors not only of conclusions but of facts pass unchallenged if they happen to be committed by a partisan of the movement. The principle laid down by Collot d'Herbois still holds good. Tout est permis pour quiconque agit dans le sens de la révolution. All this was unknown to me when I first embarked on my work. I knew that French writers of the past had distorted facts to suit their own political views, that a conspiracy of history is still directed by certain influences in the Masonic lodges and the Sorbonne. I did not know that this conspiracy was being carried on in this country. Therefore, the publisher's warning did not daunt me. If I was wrong either in my conclusions or facts, I was prepared to be challenged. Should not years of laborious historical research meet either with recognition or with reasoned and scholarly refutation? But although my book received a great many generous and appreciative reviews in the press, criticisms which were hostile took a form which I had never anticipated. Not a single honest attempt was made to refute either my French Revolution or World Revolution by the usual methods of controversy. Statements founded on documentary evidence were met with flat contradiction, unsupported by a shred of counter-evidence. In general, the plan adopted was not to disprove, but to discredit by means of flagrant misquotations, by attributing to me views I had never expressed, or even by means of offensive personalities. It will surely be admitted that this method of attack is unparalleled in any other sphere of literary controversy. It is interesting to notice that precisely the same line was adopted 100 years ago with regard to Professor Robison and the Abbé Berouel, whose works on the secret causes of the French Revolution created an immense sensation in their day. The legitimate criticisms that might have been made on their work find no place in the diatribes leveled against them. Their enemies content themselves merely with calumnies and abuse. A contemporary American writer, Seth Payson, thus describes the methods employed to discredit them.
The testimony of Professor Robison and Abbé Berouel would doubtless have been considered as ample in any case which did not interest the prejudices and passions of men against them. The scurrility and odium with which they have been loaded is perfectly natural, and what the nature of their testimony would have led one to expect. Men will endeavor to invalidate that evidence which tends to unveil their dark designs, and it cannot be expected that those who believe that the end sanctifies the means will be very scrupulous as to their measures. Certainly he was not who invented the following character and arbitrarily applied it to Dr. Robison, which might have been applied with as much propriety to any other person in Europe or America. The character here referred to is taken from the American Mercury, printed at Hartford, September 26, 1799, by E. Babcock. In this paper, on the pretended authority of Professor Ebeling, we are told that Robison had lived too fast for his income, and to supply deficiencies had undertaken to alter a bank bill, that he was detected and fled to France, that having been expelled the lodge in Edinburgh, he applied in France for the second grade, but was refused, that he made the same attempt in Germany and afterwards in Russia, but never succeeded, and from this entertained the bitterest hatred to Masonry, and after wandering about Europe for 2 years, by writing to Secretary Dundas, and presenting a copy of his book, which, it was judged, would answer certain purposes of the ministry, the prosecution against him was stopped, the professor returned in triumph to his country, and now lives upon a handsome pension, instead of suffering the fate of his predecessor Dodd.
Payson goes on to quote a writer in the National Intelligencer of January 1801, who styles himself a friend to truth and speaks of Professor Robison as a man distinguished by abject dependence on a party, by the base crimes of forgery and adultery, and by frequent paroxysms of insanity. Mounier goes further still, and in his pamphlet De l'influence attribue aux philosophes, Franks Macon's E.T. Illumines, etc., inspired by the Illuminatus Bode, quotes a story that Robison suffered from a form of insanity which consisted in his believing that the posterior portion of his body was made of glass. 3. In support of all this farrago of nonsense, there is of course no foundation of truth. Robison was a well-known savant who lived sane and respected to the end of his days. On his death, what wrote of him?
He was a man of the clearest head and the most science of anybody I have ever known, for John Playfair, in a paper read before the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 1815, whilst criticizing his proofs of a conspiracy though at the same time admitting he had himself never had access to the documents Robison had consulted, paid the following tribute to his character and erudition.
His range in science was most extensive. He was familiar with the whole circle of the accurate sciences. Nothing can add to the esteem which they, i.e. those who were personally acquainted with him, felt for his talents and worth or to the respect in which they now hold his memory.
Nevertheless, the lies circulated against both Robison and Barrowell were not without effect. 13 years later, we find another American, this time a Freemason, confessing with shame and grief and indignation that he had been carried away by the flood of vituperation poured upon Barrowell and Robison during the past 30 years, that the title pages of their works were fearful to him, and that although wishing calmly and candidly to investigate the character of Freemasonry he refused, for months, to open their books. Yet when in 1827 he read them for the first time, he was astonished to find that they showed a manifest tendency towards Freemasonry. Both Barrowell and Robison, he now realized, were learned men, candid men, lovers of their country, who had a reverence for truth and religion. They give the reasons for their opinions, they quote their authorities, naming the author and page. Like honest people, they both had a wish to rescue British Masonry from the condemnation and fellowship of Continental Masonry and appear to be sincerely actuated by the desire of doing good by giving their labors to the public. That the author was right here in his description of Barrowell's attitude to Freemasonry is shown by Barrowell's own words on the subject.
England above all is full of those upright men, excellent citizens, men of every kind and in every condition of life, who count it an honor to be Masons, and who are distinguished from other men only by ties which seem to strengthen those of benevolence and fraternal charity. It is not the fear of offending a nation amongst which I have found a refuge which prompts me to make this exception. Gratitude would prevail with me over all such terrors, and I should say in the midst of London. England is lost, she will not escape the French Revolution if the Masonic lodges resemble those I have to unveil. I would even say more. Government and all Christianity would long ago have been lost in England if one could suppose its Freemasons to be initiated into the last mysteries of the sect. England above all is full of those upright men, excellent citizens, men of every kind and in every condition of life, who count it an honor to be Masons, and who are distinguished from other men only by ties which seem to strengthen those of benevolence and fraternal charity. It is not the fear of offending a nation amongst which I have found a refuge which prompts me to make this exception. Gratitude would prevail with me over all such terrors, and I should say in the midst of London. England is lost, she will not escape the French Revolution if the Masonic lodges resemble those I have to unveil. I would even say more, government and all Christianity would long ago have been lost in England if one could suppose its Freemasons to be initiated into the last mysteries of the sect.
In another passage, Barrowell observes that Masonry in England is a society composed of good citizens in general whose chief object is to help each other by principles of equality, which for them is nothing else but universal fraternity. And again, let us admire it, the wisdom of England, for having known how to make a real source of benefit to the state out of those same mysteries which elsewhere conceal a profound conspiracy against the state and religion. 9. The only criticism British Freemasons may make on this verdict is that Barrowell regards Masonry as a system which originally contained an element of danger that has been eliminated in England, whilst they regard it as a system originally innocuous into which a dangerous element was inserted on the continent. Thus, according to the former conception, Freemasonry might be compared to one of the brass shell cases brought back from the battlefields of France and converted into a flower pot holder, whilst according to the latter it resembles an innocent brass flower pot holder which has been used as a receptacle for explosives. The fact is that, as I shall endeavor to show in the course of this book, Freemasonry being a composite system, there is some justification for both these theories. In either case, it will be seen that Continental Masonry alone stands condemned. The plan of representing Robison and Barrowell as the enemies of British Masonry can therefore only be regarded as a method for discrediting them in the eyes of British Freemasons, and consequently for bringing the latter over to the side of their antagonists. Exactly the same method of attack has been directed against those of us who during the last few years have attempted to warn the world of the secret forces working to destroy civilization. In my own case, even the plan of accusing me of having attacked British Masonry has been adopted without the shadow of a foundation. From the beginning, I have always differentiated between British and Grand Orient Masonry, and have numbered High British Masons amongst my friends. But what is the main charge brought against us? like Robison and Barrowell, we are accused of raising a false alarm, of creating a bogey, or of being the victims of an obsession. Up to a point, this is comprehensible. Whilst on the continent, the importance of secret societies is taken as a matter of course, and the libraries of foreign capitals teem with books on the question, people in this country really imagine that secret societies are things of the past. Articles to this effect appeared quite recently in two leading London newspapers, whilst practically nothing of any value has been written about them in our language during the last 100 years. Hence, ideas that are commonplaces on the continent here appear sensational and extravagant. The mind of the Englishman does not readily accept anything he cannot see, or even sometimes anything he can see which is unprecedented in his experience, so that like the West American farmer, confronted for the first time by the sight of a giraffe, his impulse is to cry out angrily, "I don't believe it." But whilst making all allowance for honest ignorance and incredulity, it is impossible not to recognize a certain method in the manner in which the cry of obsession or bogey is raised. For it will be noticed that people who specialize on other subjects are not described as obsessed. We did not hear, for example, that the late Professor Einstein had relativity on the brain because he wrote and lectured exclusively on this question, nor do we hear it suggested that Mr. Howard Carter is obsessed with the idea of Tutankhamun and that it would be well if he were to set out for the South Pole by way of a change. Again, all those who warn the world concerning eventualities they conceive to be a danger are not accused of creating bogeys. Thus, although Lord Roberts was denounced as a scaremonger for urging the country to prepare for defense against a design openly avowed by Germany both in speech and print, and in 1921 the Duke of Northumberland was declared the victim of a delusion for believing in the existence of a plot against the British Empire which had been proclaimed in 1,000 revolutionary harangues and pamphlets. People who, without bothering to produce a shred of documentary evidence, had sounded the alarm on the menace of French imperialism and asserted that our former allies were engaged in building a vast fleet of aeroplanes in order to attack our coasts. They were not held to be either scaremongers or insane. On the contrary, although some of these same people were proved by events to have been completely wrong in their prognostications at the beginning of the Great War, they are still regarded as oracles and sometimes even described as thinking for half Europe. Another instance of this kind may be cited in the case of Mr. John Spargo, author of a small book entitled The Jew and American Ideals. On page 37 of this work, Mr. Spargo, in refuting the accusations brought against the Jews, observes,
"Belief in widespread conspiracies directed against individuals or the state is probably the commonest form assumed by the human mind when it loses its balance and its sense of proportion."
Yet, on page 6, Mr. Spargo declares that when visiting this country in September and October 1920,
"I found in England great nationwide organizations, obviously well-financed, devoted to the sinister purpose of creating anti-Jewish feeling and sentiment. I found special articles in influential newspapers devoted to the same evil purpose. I found at least one journal, obviously well-financed again, exclusively devoted to the fostering of suspicion, fear, and hatred against the Jew. And in the bookstores I discovered a whole library of books devoted to the same end."
It will be seen then that a belief in widespread conspiracies is not always to be regarded as a sign of loss of mental balance, even when these conspiracies remain completely invisible to the general public. For those of us who were in London during the period of Mr. Spargo's visit saw nothing of the things he here describes. Where, we ask, were these great nationwide organizations striving to create anti-Jewish sentiments? What were their names? By whom were they led? It is true, however, that there were nationwide organizations in existence here at this date instituted for the purpose of combating Bolshevism. Is anti-Bolshevism then synonymous with anti-Semitism? This is the conclusion to which one is inevitably led. For it will be noticed that anyone who attempts to expose the secret forces behind the revolutionary movement, whether he mentions Jews in this connection or even if he goes out of his way to exonerate them, will incur the hostility of the Jews and their friends and will still be described as anti-Semite. The realization of this fact has led me particularly to include the Jews in the study of secret societies. The object of the present book is therefore to carry further the inquiry I began in World Revolution by tracing the course of revolutionary ideas through secret societies from the earliest times, indicating the role of the Jews only where it is to be clearly detected, but not seeking to implicate them where good evidence is not forthcoming. For this reason, I shall not base assertions on merely anti-Semite works, but principally on the writings of the Jews themselves. In the same way with regard to secret societies, I shall rely as far as possible on the documents and admissions of their members, on which point I have been able to collect a great deal of fresh data entirely corroborating my former thesis. It should be understood that I do not propose to give a complete history of secret societies, but only of secret societies in their relation to the revolutionary movement. I shall therefore not attempt to describe the theories of occultism nor to inquire into the secrets of Freemasonry, but simply to relate the history of these systems in order to show the manner in which they have been utilized for a subversive purpose. If I then fail to convince the incredulous that secret forces of revolution exist, it will not be for want of evidence.
So there you have it, folks. This is a fantastic work, and thank you for staying with me on that. I know it was long. Go back and replay it. It runs from about the 7 minute eight, I'm sorry, one, the 8 minute mark to about the 25 minute mark in this clip, in this podcast. Teens and their minions have labeled it anti-Semitic, just as everything else that challenges these subversive movements. You heard her say that. I think you can equate anti-Bolshevism or anti-communism or anti-wokeism today with being an anti-Semite. You know, she mentioned that there are many great reviews. In fact, we heard Nancy read the one from H.G. Wells. Well, there's a lot more, folks, and it's up on the banner. Take a look at it. This is the back of the edition I have. Worldwide appreciation. The very top one is what Nancy read. Then there's a, I'm going to count them here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 other favorable reviews. From sources as diverse as the New York Book Review, the New York Herald Tribune, to the English Review, to the Spectator, which said there's an undoubtedly much neglected truth in what she says. Folks, another one from the Church of Ireland Gazette says, curiously intriguing book. John O. London's Weekly, a bestseller. We are being lied to, folks. Then did you notice? She mentioned the British versus the Orient Freemasonry. Well, that's what I always talk about, is the battle between the British and the French Freemasons. Now, I can go on and on about this, folks. It's a very fascinating topic, but we have to keep moving. And right now, it's time for Brother Alex's and Sister Kathy's Freaky Dinky News Update. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with our coronavirus heist update. And that proverbial they, folks, are the Sabatinians, the Frankists. Call them the Democrats and the uniparty of the rhinos today. Call them whatever you want, the deep states, the swamp. There are subversive movements operating through secret societies, folks. But before I go off on that, and we're going to focus the majority of this show today on the Sabatinians, we have to give our sudden adult death syndrome update. Now, Canada's health director of parliamentary affairs, the guy who led Canada's response team to COVID-19 and the death jab rollout, he dies at 35 years old. So the director of parliamentary affairs of Health Canada, Adam Exton, a longtime Liberal Party organizer, died suddenly last Friday, according to his family. And here's how his obituary reads. It is with great sadness that the family of Adam Exton announced his passing. Oh, actually, it was December 9th, at the age of 35, in Ottawa, Ontario. Much loved son of Wendy Exton, brother of Bradley Exton, Ellen Wessel, and son of Alan Exton, he will also be deeply missed by his loving girlfriend, Risha, as well as his many cousins, aunts, uncles, and grandmother, Betty Redmond.
As a young person, Adam actively involved in politics and had a passion for public service and volunteering in the community. In 2012, Adam won the Ontario Young Liberal Volunteer of the Year Award. He received a degree in political science from the University of Toronto, spent many years working at various levels of government, and eventually holding the position of Director of Parliamentary Affairs in Health Canada. That was the entire obituary, folks, and I read it for a reason. As usual, no mention of his death. It's normal for a 35-year-old to die. Nobody in the corporate media is even asking a single question concerning this, folks. None at all. All of these news reports basically follow the same formula. You should know it by now. With these sudden adult deaths, they declare the death happened. They note that the cause or case is unknown. And in this case, they didn't even mention that. And then they go straight to the quotes from friends and family, ignoring the odd fact that so many people between 20 and 50 are dying unexpectedly. And sadly, most in the alternative media, they avoid these stories too because they don't want to be deplatformed. And nearly everyone in the conservative media pretends the stories just simply don't exist. Don't even get me going on the corporate media, folks. They're zip, nada. Here's how they report on it. Now, I'm going to promise you one thing, folks. I'll never do that. I don't care how controversial the subject is. As I am given spiritual light and spiritual sight, I'm going to share it with you, folks. And that I do promise you. So anyways, this is a crazy, topsy-turvy world, totally insane. And there are a lot more sad reports this week, but for the sake of time, we have to keep moving. Now, this next story, this next clip, I've been contemplating about putting it into the Hopium Report, but I just couldn't wait that long into the show because even the biggest libtards are beginning to wake up. I don't know if you heard, but Tim Robbins, the liberal acting legend himself, you know, the partner of Susan Sarandon, the other libtard wacko, was on Russell Brand's podcast recently, and he told the comedy legend Russell how dystopian things got during the COVID-era lockdown. He actually said, we turned into tribal, angry, vengeful people. And this is one of the methodologies out of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, which was actually a foundation of the Sabbatean teaching from the 15th century. So in this next clip, and it's amazing, but it's 11 minutes and 11 seconds long. And I know a couple of these are rather long this week, but folks, you have to get the entire flavor for these clips. And so many podcasts play these short clips, you can't really put it in context. And that's the reason I do this. So let's take a listen to Tim's interview with Russell Brand and just go through this, and then I'll comment it on the other side. Here goes.
Stay free with me, Russell Brand.
Why did you feel it necessary to speak out against some of the measures that took place socially during the period of the pandemic? What was important and significant about it for you?
Well, first let me say that I didn't at first. I bought into it. I was someone that, you know, I went through a pretty unique experience in Los Angeles you know, was locked down there. I have a nonprofit theater company that had to shutter, and we started doing our work online, and I was masking everywhere. I was keeping my social distance. So I was adhering to the requests made of me, and I felt, you know, angry at people that didn't do that. I felt angry at there was a protest in Orange County, I remember, of people that didn't want to put masks on. Mm. Got very angry about that. And as time progressed, I eventually got out of Los Angeles. I drove cross country and saw areas of the country that were not adhering to the policies, and eventually wound up isolating myself in New York State for a good 7 months. And it wasn't until I came to the UK in January of 2021 that I started to have questions. And I was here on a job, and I noticed that people, this was in the midst of the worst part of the lockdown here, and I noticed a lot of people were not adhering, again, to these requests made by their government. And I thought, well, they're going to have a hard day coming up, you know, that there will be some serious death here. And, you know, I kept my I kept my mask on, and I kept adhering to the policies. But it wasn't until much later that I started to have questions. And when I saw that there wasn't a huge death rate here after I'd witnessed personally what was happening, I started to wonder more and more about what we were being told and whether it was true or not. And so it took a while for me to speak about it. I was staying in Soho, and I was there one Saturday morning, and I heard a lot of noise outside, and it was a protest, an anti-lockdown protest. And I went out. I had a bicycle, and I went out, and I joined the protest, not because I was joining the protest, because I was curious about what was going on. And I started talking to people, and I saw the way that they were being described in the press, and it wasn't true. These were not, National Front Nazis. These were liberals and lefties and people that believed in personal freedom. And I began to educate myself, and I began to open my mind to what was going on. It was a very different political environment in the United States, very divisive, very much based on politics. If you were, well, it changed. At first, if you were a Democrat when Trump was president, well, you weren't going to take that vaccine because it was Trump's vaccine. And then that seemed to somehow change. It was kind of Orwellian. It was like we are no longer at war with East Asia. Now we were thinking about it a different way. And if you didn't take the vaccine, you were a Republican. And it wasn't that way here in England. It was a much more tolerant attitude towards the diversity of opinion. And so I was really grateful to have been in this experience so that I could get a different perspective.
Perhaps part of your perspective was born of a kind of Swiftian travel, and you would be a good Gulliver because you are a giant in numerous contexts. But like, because I would say that kind of authoritarianism and the certainty that necessarily accompanies it was present in the media and the state diktats in this country also. What I find interesting, and again, laudable in what you've done, is that you've undertaken your own journey from what was a de facto position of, like, we were told it was a unique health emergency and that the measures undertaken were necessary in order to protect human life. What more noble goal could there be? But as this has unfolded, the position has to be amended. It's become clear that many of the original measures were not as rigidly undergirded as was first claimed. And in fact, as you have explained, there is a lot more political ideology at play than is perhaps wise, prudent, or even honest when the claim that's being made is that we are following science. That's irrefutable, evidence-based measures. So, Tim, if something like a pandemic becomes politicized to this degree, if conversation becomes shut down, if condemnation of unvaccinated people becomes as sanctioned, like, you know, on CNN when Don Lemon was saying that, you know, these people are idiots and we should shame them, when certain people were saying that they should be denied health care, when Joe Rogan was condemned for sort of having a conversation, it indicates that the climate that we're living in has radically altered. And one of the things that I like to continually reiterate is that nobody here is saying that the vaccines don't have a positive impact or that we oughtn't do everything in our power to protect human life. It's simply that if you have authoritarianism where conversation is shut down, you are losing one of the great treasures, perhaps the primary treasure, of democracy. Do you feel, Tim, that the pandemic revealed something about the nature of establishment power, the aesthetics of establishment power, and perhaps the way that liberalism itself is changing?
Well, I think it started to reveal itself when we became aware of the idea that the vaccinated could spread it and catch it like the unvaccinated. So to continue the policy of lockdowns or mandates after that didn't seem to be following the science. It seemed to be following a political agenda.
Mm.
And so that's where I really started to have problems with it. There were a few instances that were really disturbing to me. One was when the, I believe it was the CDC or the FDA, changed the definition of a vaccine on their website. Another was that when they denied that natural immunity was something. So there was an awful lot of people that got COVID early on. I believe I did in February of 2020. I was in Seattle on tour with a play with the Actors Gang, and I got very sick. And in the past, natural immunity is one of the building blocks to moving forward. Some people get vaccinated, some people have natural immunity, and eventually we have, what do they call that?
Herd immunity.
Herd immunity. So the fact that there were these change of definitions was something that my alarm bells went off. And so I wondered what is going on, what is beyond the very real idea of taking care of people and making sure that we don't have a terrible death rate. But then we also became aware that the most people at risk were either immunocompromised or elderly. And then when you consider that the WHO, the World Health Organization, changed its protocol on virus outbreaks, which in the past had been you lock down the vulnerable, you take care of them, you make sure they're taken care of, but you let society go on so that it can build its herd immunity. This was changed as well. We went into lockdown with healthy people, with children, and that didn't seem to be wise to me. So I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. I don't know the intricacies of data on this. All I can respond to is as someone that is concerned about what the result of those doctrines, that policy had on us as human beings. And it's not good. We turned into tribal, angry, vengeful people. And I don't think that's something that is sustainable for the earth, that we start demonizing people that don't agree with our particular health policies and turn them into monsters, turn them into pariahs, say that they don't deserve a hospital bed. I think about, people that have made bad mistakes in their lives where they take too many drugs and they overdose. And that's totally their choice. That's totally their responsibility. Yet we take care of them. Yet we bring them to the hospital. Yet we save their lives because we're compassionate, because we want to make sure that people live. And this turned. It turned into you should fucking die because you have not complied. That's incredibly dangerous.
Watch entire episodes on demand for free at rumble.com/Russell Brand.
Well done, Timmy. Well done, brother. All I can say there, folks, is
Well done. But stick around, buddy, because you're only in scene one of this psychodrama. You know, folks, it's very entertaining to watch some of these celebrities taking baby steps into critical thinking, you know, reality and logic. Now, they're a little slow, but at least some of them, like good old Tim here and Russell, they aren't irreparably dense. Did you hear him mention herd immunity? So true, Timmy. Just look at China right now, folks. 30, pushing 40 million cases this week. What is that, around 15% of the population? And why? Why is this happening? Well, the reason it's happening, folks, is that they practice stringent lockdown. And they did not allow what Timmy mentioned, herd immunity, to function. But wait. Just wait, folks. Wait until he finds the truth about climate change. You know, this big scam that's happened when Maurice Strong loaded the deck concerning global warming and how we're going to quantify it decades ago at the Rio Summit. And, you know, we covered that on this show too, folks. Now, praise the Lord, people. The world's waking up. They're waking up to the fact that there's a scam concerning climate change. In fact, did you hear that AOC's climate change propaganda flick, I mean documentary, flopped at the box office, only bringing in $80 for theater? You can't even make this stuff up, folks. You know, she's part of this gang, you know, and they're promoting this Sabbatean lie. Why? Ordo ab Cao. They need a one-world government. So her little flick only brought in $80 at the theater, and that's because people are waking up. That's right, Paul, only $80 per theater. Like Trump said, the climate scam is falling apart, but don't think I'm some kind of MAGA Trump supporter. I'm not, folks. More on him a bit later in the show. But the next question I have to ask you, will Timmy swallow the red pill too concerning this whole Great Reset, or is he going to just get back into being a self-righteous, angry liberal in his tribal knowledge? That's the real question. You know, these red pills always don't go down that easily. And the later you wait to get into the game, so to speak, the bigger the red pill you have to swallow. It's better to take little doses of red pill over the years. That's how I did it, folks, pushing 40 years now. In fact, we all need to wake up, because we are truly headed towards actual Nazi fascism, with the liberals brainwashed by the Sabbateans, who basically command, do as I say and do, or off with your head. And quite literally, you're going to hear that in the Absurdian Report. Comment on one of their Twitter or Instagram posts if you can, and if they don't block you, or if the platform doesn't throttle you, you can't even get any discussion in, any critical thinking. So I hope a lot of people woke up when Tim Robbins spoke out on Russell Brand's podcast. And that thought brings to mind a classic clip from an old movie titled The Red Menace. I don't know if you've heard of it, folks, but it's a very good story. And there's a clip I want to play out of it right now, about a minute and a half, titled Democrats and the Communist Party. Just take a listen. Having a little lag here, folks.
All my years in the party, I thought that I could be an American Democrat and a communist at the same time. That if it came to an issue, some of the teachings of Marx might be abandoned. I see now I was wrong. Under the circumstances, I find no alternative but to withdraw from the party. Now that I'm no longer fettered by a dictatorship, I can tell you trained Red Seals a few of the things that have been on my mind. You shout about progress and reforms and entice young progressives into the party, when behind their backs in your council meetings you sneer at them as weak-minded simpletons for being stupid enough to join. I found this committee to be made up chiefly of psychopathic misfits who are seeking an outlet for their frustrations and failures. Only people like that could accept the party line with its corkscrew tactics and its grandstand plate XGIs and its lies about the government that's trying to help solve their problems. You crusade for liberalism,
The only kind of liberalism you know is in the purse strings of the Communist Party. It pours money into the pockets of men who haven't the brains of sincerity to hold a decent job. You pretend to fight racial discrimination, but you keep reminding me that I'm a Jewish American, that Sam down in the office is a Negro American, that Molly over here is an Irish American. We're none of us hyphens, we're just plain Americans. Don't sneer at me. Tell me I'm waving a flag, all right. But at least that flag has three colors in it, not one. Not one bloody one.
Wow, folks. You know, this guy that you heard speaking, his name was Solomon. He was a Jew who wanted to be identified as an American, not a Jewish American, not like his friend Molly, who was Irish, didn't want to be identified as an Irish American, but that's what they do to divide and conquer. So this guy, Solomon, he wakes up. He was their pamphlet writer. And he wrote a line, pamphlet, that Karl Marx's ideas were not original, but they derived from Friedrich Hegel, you know, the problem, reaction, solution guy. You know, we've talked about that ad nauseum here on this show. Problem, reaction, solution. Ordo ab chao. Thesis, synthesis, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, I should say. Shorthand for dialectic materialism. So the tribe turned on him when he was trying to speak the light of truth, just like they're going to turn on good old Timmy, just like they've done to Yi if you cross that line. So this guy was a hardcore lefty, just like Timmy, and it's actually interesting to listen to these folks. They articulate so well as their eyes are being opened. If only more people stopped for a second and took a look around instead of following blindly everything the media and the government, who are becoming fascistic in the sense that, you know, look at these Twitter dumps. That's the definition of fascism, private ownership, government control. Now, if you can read more on this movie, The Red Menace, there's a really good review by Colby Malsbury out on TribalTheocrat.com. And a bit more on the Red Menace later in the show. Right now we have to keep moving. Time for our Kabuki Theater update.
COVID-19, George Floyd, Rice, BLM, police reform, the 2020 election. All merely coincidence? I hardly think so. Folks, it's called Kabuki Theater from Japanese. Ka means salt. Bu means dance. Ki means skill from the verb. Kabu means to slant or to sway. Folks, it's all a lie. It's the flatten the curve. The curve of the economy, stupid, must slow down the velocity of money. Portal hyperinflation before we're done. Stealing it all. Trump, bad. Must go. Good is bad. Bad is good. Up is down. Light is dark. It's all Kabuki Theater, folks. Prepping the masses for agenda 2030 and the new world war. Just say no to it all and wake up before it's too late.
Now, just like that last clip, folks, I was going to put this one in the Hopium Report, but I moved it up here to the Kabuki Theater. This time, there's a reason to my madness, not just that I wanted to get it onto the show faster or sooner. I'll tell you why in a minute. But in this clip, Harry Lake was speaking at Mar-a-Lago, what was it, last Saturday night, I think it was, and she's on fire. Now, she uses a vulgar word in here, so if you have children, and I apologize, you have to recognize, folks, there's going to be some words that aren't appropriate sometimes used in these clips. I don't speak that way, but these other people speaking the truth do. So when I'm going to play a clip, just assume there may be something sensitive in it that you don't want young ones to hear. But just have a listen to what Carrie said at Mar-a-Lago, I think it was last Saturday night.
And we just had such a huge movement going into the election day, so we couldn't watch these evil bastards. Can I say that weird? Is that all right? To watch them steal this in broad daylight, and if they think they're going to get away with this, they messed with the wrong bitch, okay?
Now, I just love Carrie Lake's attitude. She's like a rock, and I love that, you know. She's sassy. She has stamina. She speaks the truth, and she's very articulate with her thoughts and her feelings towards all this corruption. It's a slap and a kiss all in one, so to speak. You know, folks, the truth is that the United States peaked back in the 50s after the contrived World War II. And today, there's just a few out there like Kerry and some of these MAGA Republicans, and I'm not so convinced this isn't controlled opposition. But at least they're speaking the truth. And in my opinion, all they're doing is simply slowing the slide into this world where we're going to see the unveiling of the Antichrist. And forget about standing up on religious ideals in this current climate. You know, there's a godless anti-theology mindset entrenched in the ideals and principles of our current Western culture that's going to go down with the ship. You know, the international Marxist movement has been alive for a long time. That clip we played was back from the 40s. And their goal is to knock the United States off its number one perch as the dominant military and economic power in the world. And as George Soros has said, who's a Sabbatean, they want to make China number one. And all of this started in the 60s with detente and the things that Nixon and his administration were doing with China. And then we had the transformation, one of Obama's favorite words that was just facilitated through every other administration, red or blue alike, Republican or Democrat, it didn't matter. Now, Reagan slowed it a little bit, and W. Bush tried to in his first 2 years, then it all folded. Now, along comes Trump, and he slowed the transition a little bit more, but right now it's right back in high gear. And that's why they supposedly hate Trump. This is the false dialectic here, you know? Dialectic materialism, problem, reaction, solution. That's what they're doing. So did you ever hear of this movie, The Red Menace, until I played the clip a few minutes ago? Well, there's two things from that review I mentioned before I get into this next point from the movie. The first is this movie was produced by Republic Pictures. It was the token Gentile movie studio run by a man named Herbert J. Yates, the studio leader, in the wasteland of Jewry, as the reviewer says, that had fully subsumed Hollywood long before the 1940s. So Republic Pictures had long been the stable of pictures catering to those good old Americana type shows, you know, by John Wayne and John Ford. So Republic spirit of patriotism and truth and all that would accommodate these anti-communist movies far more comfortably than the larger Sabbatean studios would. Those who are attempting to foist the Stalinistic view of World War II on an unsuspecting public with their slate of war movies. And if you looked at all of them that came out right after the war, ones like Mission to Moscow and The North Star, you'll see what I'm talking about. The movie was narrated by Lloyd G. Davies. He was a member of the City Council of Los Angeles, California. Now, that seems strange today that there's even an Anglo-Saxon name, Lloyd G. Davies, on the ranks of the L.A. municipal government. You know, today that's about as common as teeth for Henrietta, let alone somebody that would lead or narrate on a project such as this. You know, today all you're going to get is somebody with a name like Yolanda Escobedo Sterngold, and she'd only agree to narrate a PBS special report on the LGBTQ plus movement during the Watts riots or something stupid like that. Now, this was the brutal truth about the Democratic Party back then and even more so today, except it's now encompassed the entire uniparty, the Rhino Republicans and the Democrats. Folks, it's so clear and concise, the message of this movie. They said, sadly, nothing has changed. In fact, it's only gotten worse. And the reason is that the Democrats are so aligned with the Communist Party, so perfected in their methodologies of the Sabbateans. Their roots are so deep in this that it's almost unstoppable at this point. So what I'd like to do now is play this 4 minute and 44 second clip, full clip of where we heard Solomon rip up his Communist Party member card in the earlier clip. This is the context of that. Just have a listen.
As you all probably know, this meeting was called by the National Committee. One of the important duties of the party committee is to study and direct the works of communist writers, scientists, and musicians, and to see that their efforts do not deviate from the approved party line. One of the members of this group has been accused of such deviation. Henry Solomon's poem, written in honor of Karl Marx, has been found objectionable.
Well, that poem was submitted months ago. Why should the committee suddenly find it out of line?
Are you putting your puny mind up against the committee's?
I'm just wondering whether it was the committee that found that poem objectionable or whether that decision came from some higher body outside of this country.
Henry, why don't you let Mr. Patters continue so that we can hear what the objection is?
In your poem, you spoke of Marx making the ancient dream of paradise breathe on earth, about opening graves where liberty sleep and old ghosts springing forth. These phrases would indicate that Marx merely carried on the work of other men instead of originating his own doctrine.
This is ridiculous. Every student knows that Marx developed the ideas of Hegel, and these went way back to Democritus in ancient Greece.
You see, he is a deviationist. I knew it all along.
Are you conducting this meeting, Ivan?
Do you mean to tell me that just because I'm a communist, I have to deny the facts of biography and history?
You must follow the communist conception of history, Mr. Solomon. We contend that Karl Marx had no basis in Hegel, Democritus, or anybody else.
I heard of things like this being put over in communist-dominated countries. Philosophers being compelled to deny the facts they uncovered. Musicians forced to compose the kind of music that ignorant commissars demanded, and poets and journalists denied the freedom of expression. Oh, but I never thought I'd find injustice like this in America.
Solomon, there's just one issue here. Will you or will you not publicly retract the opinions you expressed in this poem?
I'd rather say that the issue is whether I, as an American citizen, as well as a communist, have the right to freedom of expression and opinion.
Henry, you should know better than that. What you call freedom is license. The license to put your own will against the party line.
In all my years in the party, I thought that I could be an American Democrat and a communist at the same time. That if it came to an issue, some of the teachings of Marx might be abandoned. See, now I was wrong. Under the circumstances, I find no alternative but to withdraw from the party. Now that I'm no longer fettered by a dictatorship, I can tell you trained Red Seals a few of the things that have been on my mind. You shout about progress and reforms and entice young progressives into the party, when behind their backs in your council meetings you sneer at them as weak-minded simpletons for being stupid enough to join. I found this committee to be made up chiefly of psychopathic misfits who are seeking an outlet for their frustrations and failures. Only people like that could accept the party line with its corkscrew tactics and its grandstand plate XGIs and its lies about the government that's trying to help solve their problems. You crusade for liberalism. The only kind of liberalism you know is in the purse strings of the Communist Party. It pours money into the pockets of men who haven't the brains of sincerity to hold a decent job. You pretend to fight racial discrimination, but you keep reminding me that I'm a Jewish American, that Sam down in the office is a Negro American, that Molly over here is an Irish American. We're none of us hyphens, we're just plain Americans. Don't sneer at me. Tell me I'm waving a flag, all right. But at least that flag has three colors in it, not one. Not one bloody one.
What a traitor. Trotskyite. If I had my way, I'd...
The committee will deal with him, Ivan.
Trotskyite. Did you hear that, folks? So this newly red-pilled man, the Jew Solomon, who was waking up, so to speak, like Timmy, was labeled a deviationist, called a Trotskyite. And today, if you question the Holocaust,
for the tenets of being an anti-Semite. You're called a revisionist historian. Folks, what you're seeing at play here is the Sabbatean ploy to undermine reality. So some call it propaganda, this movie I'm referring to, and compare it to the hit piece that was created to outlaw cannabis, known as Reefer Madness. But I'm telling you, folks, that's simply not true. Cannabis is a medicinal herb. It's not medical marijuana. It's a medicinal herb with millennia of proven health benefits, taken away from we the people by the same villains, the minions of the Sabbateans. Whereas in the movie The Red Menace, they're trying to expose this subterfuge, so to speak, you know? But we have to keep moving. And right now it's time for our newest segment, Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow, 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 follow.
Now, as you may have heard, this corrupt Congress has just approved this massive omnibus spending bill that includes funding for monuments to the D.C. journalists. Can you believe this crap, folks? You know, Congress has this horrible approval rating right now, and they had to do some stopgap measures. Whatever happened to a budget? And this story is a perfect explanation of why these two things are so true. Opinion for both Congress and the media. This massive spending bill, $1.7 trillion, is going to fund monuments to the media in Washington, D.C. Yeah, Paul, exactly. Why? Why does it include money for the media? Well, there's a reason behind this, folks. You see, the government, through their intelligence agencies, are funding psyops on We the People. Follow the Yellow Brick Road, folks. That's all you need to do. Now, here's a clip from a documentary, another must-see. This is the intro to this fantastic work titled Enjoy the Show. So what I'd like to do now is play the first 4 minutes from this documentary. This is the director's cut. And if you can't find it, just go out to YouTube. It's still up there now. It's titled Enjoy the Show, Director's Cut. And I urge you to watch it. It'd be great watching with family members over the holiday here. But let's have a listen to the intro.
People who work with government agencies like the CIA know the power of Hollywood entertainment and use it for control. Psychological operations, PSYOPs for short, have their own divisions in the U.S. military and are used by agencies to manipulate what you know.
Good evening, I'm Ron Burgundy.
Entertainment, news, and media are the front lines of the new war. A fifth-generation war of perception. How agencies and governments maintain power and control of you. How do I know this? I trained with the NSA in the same underground bunker in Hawaii where Snowden was. My career accelerated through a lengthy list of roles and assignments in privatized intelligence and unknown agencies. I ended up on suicide missions around the world. I was to be in Benghazi during the horrific siege. I knew the people there. I helped coordinate the logistics. But my plans changed, miraculously.
We're all hoping you'll be on your best behavior here in Pakistan.
To take down nations, you first break their elections. And if that doesn't work, agencies come in with guns blazing and allege something happened. I know, because I helped fix 45 elections around the world, most notably Ukraine. The Bush and Obama administrations intervened in elections for decades. The agencies got the work done. I got the work done. The State Department, under the guise of spreading freedom and democracy, was actually overthrowing governments through infiltration, using PSYOPs, acting like you were there to help, but actually rigging elections, inciting protests, riots, and at times, armed violence. But I decided to leave the power structure running the world. I'm Tori Says. I educate the people to help them take back their power. You need to understand that you've been toyed with, your psychology hacked like a computer. The agencies have done cultural infiltration of entertainment, news, and media in the United States of America. It's time you learn about these weapons of war, privatized to corporations, and now being used on you. Psychological operations. Manipulating information to control you and your government. This is a rare sneak peek behind the curtain of how governments and their intelligence agencies deceive and manipulate you. Enjoy the show. The movie you have been watching and participating in. The question you should ask is, who is running the show? Decision time. Spectator or participant? How do you wake up the population?
I'll tell you who's running the show, folks. The show is being run by the Sabbateans, the Illuminati, the Frankists, the Uniparty of today. This fascist system where the 1,000 largest corporations want to create this great reset and govern the world as one. So I can't stress enough the importance of this documentary. Now, there's another one called Out of the Shadows. That's an appetizer. Watch that one, too. And right now, I'm looking to another one called The Zeitgeist Addendum. But more on that later, folks. In fact, I'm going to write that one down. So we got Trot, Eite, and we've got The Zeitgeist Addendum. I want to talk more about these things on future shows, but we have to keep moving. And right now it's time for Coop Talk with Henrietta. Hey, Henrietta. Hey, do you have hen's teeth? No, I didn't think you did. But you know what? It is cold today, folks. In fact, I just stepped out during that clip to listen to the wind and to look at the weather. Oh, my. It's below zero here right now. And can anybody say weather control? Now, what I'd like to talk about in this show is a time-sensitive connection that I've made. And I usually do this with J.D. Ruckers. It's happened uncannily time after time on topic after topic. But just this week, while I was thinking about this topic to discuss during Coop Talk, I stumbled on this article titled Urban versus Rural, Notional versus Real from the American Sun. And this was an article posted by Richard Greenhorn on December 21st. So like I said, very relevant, very time sensitive. And, you know, I've been telling you to flee from cities in the suburbs as quickly as you can for years. In fact, I was motivated to buy this property with Terry and two dear friends back in 1985, folks. I had something on my heart. I knew I had to get out of the city and the suburbs. But, you know, to be honest with you, folks, I realized that rural life is really no safe refuge against the onslaught of the Sabbatean ploy to create this Luciferian one-world government. It's an onslaught of leftist aggression, folks. Now, don't get me wrong. Small-town life in rural America does have its problems, but nothing remotely comparable to what you see in the big cities. So the main reason to escape the cities, if you can, is to experience this last meaningful vestige of life as it once was for millennia. Before that true metaverse, which isn't Facebook, but rather streaming TV, smartphones, in effect, the Black Mirror, which are replacing reality for this generation and every generation to come. I mean, today people think they could just open up a phone app and trade Bitcoin and create wealth. That's a lie, folks. You have to apply labor to substance. You have to mine it, farm it, manufacture it, grow it. And if you don't do that, you're not creating wealth. Now, in small towns across America, there still exist people that came of age before this cultural revolution in 1968. You know, the hippie movement? Guys who dress in plaid shirts and wear suspenders and trousers, not, and women whose idea of being social is bringing a casserole and a cake to the potluck at the community gathering every Friday night. And there are still out there diners that are privately owned that didn't get run out of business by Applebee's or the Olive Garden, where they blare this classic rock all the time. And there are still these little coffee shops to play the local lousy Christian station rather than the acoustic noodling of these hipster groanings, you know, that you hear at Starbucks. That kind of stuff, you know, with the guitar twang in the back. Yet sadly, this generation and the way of life that we call Americana is passing away. By the way, folks, that's why Terry and I love to vacation up at the cottage on the Lake Erie, that is, in this small town like stepping back into the 50s called Ripley, New York, and Westfield, which is right down the road from them. But like I said, these places are quickly fading away. For example, if you live near a big pork or chicken or turkey plant out in the country somewhere, your town's probably already started to metamorphosize, you know, with foreigners in there to work at these plants as slave labor. But where there still are remnants of the old ways, where they still exist, you simply couldn't be any freer than you are there. So you better take the time to teach your children what freedom looks like, folk, before it's all gone. Now, sure, there may be the local tattoo artist there, but not all of them are like that. My brother Seth has disassociated from the tattoo scene because they're so woke. And sure, you got the librarian that might put up the rainbow flag for Pride Month, but they're not flooding the streets with all this perversion like they do in the big cities. In the cities, the tenor and the tempo of life itself is led by these activist freaks, these violent criminals, the bohemians of whatever sort of cause they're on. And this is all Sabbatean in nature, folks. Now, in the suburbs, it's a little different. The tone and temper, they're set by the professionals and the bureaucrats. You know, you have your little sandbox you have to play in. The Overton window, so to speak. But in the country and in small towns across America, you know, the flyover country, the tenor of life is still set by real men and real women. People with chests and backbones. Chests, men with a heart, like C.S. Lewis said in The Abolition of Man. The ones who in the past have erected the skyscrapers of our cities and built the downtowns. And those of the present age still work with their hands in the fields and factories and garages across America. The people still know how to swap an engine or can tomatoes and everything else in between. But like I said, sadly, this is all passing away, folks.
But I see the remnants of the world that my grandparents and my parents and even my generation built this great nation upon. It's passing away, folks. And when it does, it'll be gone, lost forever. So if you can see this, it's not only useful for personal happiness, but as a reminder of what really reality truly is. You know, many of these perennial conflicts on the right arise from this inability to differentiate the real from the imaginary. Even the people in the truth movement have a problem with this. So let me ask you a question. What is real? Well, it's life as humanity knew it for generations. You know, working with nature, living in small communities, integrating with other races and religions, having friendships and kin groups and all of that. Now, on the other hand, this imaginary metaverse is some pseudo-ideological battle being waged almost solely in the digital sphere. And at the forefront of it right now is Elon Musk's Twitter. Now, in this imaginary realm, the only thing that's surviving are memes and vibe shifts in this Overton window that I mentioned. It's all in your mind, folks. It's a psyop. Now, it achieves victories by capturing enough minds, like we heard in that intro, to enjoy the show, create what's known as an ideological realm. Oh, and by the way, folks, this is all Sabbatean methodology taught by the Kabbalah. Read the Talmud. It's in there too, folks. This goes all the way back to the battle between Cain and Abel, where Cain killed Abel. That became the Canaanites, folks. So they create these meme wars. And that's why Elon Musk said that control of Twitter can determine the death or life of Western civilization. Now, that thought is worth pondering upon, because in the past, in order for an ideology to hold such sway over actual civilization, it required the smashing down of altars, the commandeering of troops, and the murder of a couple thousand or maybe 100,000 or even millions of peasants like they did in the Holodrama. The Sabbateans, folks, the Jews, that I'm not allowed to utter. So these Sabbateans, the Frankists, the Jacobians, call them whatever you want. They'll blather about liberty and equality and fraternity. But just like Solomon said in those clips, don't step off the reservation or they're going to destroy you. So in the past, they needed a market economy with centralized bureaucracy, position of the haves and the have-nots. So the real conditions of the social order enabled these ideologies to gain momentum. And that's how the Sabbateans operated in the past. But now they've moved. They don't need to use Marxist ideology, the proletariat, you know, the Bolsheviks. They don't need all that. That's in the past. Today, class warfare isn't really the way to do it. Identity warfare is the way they're doing it. So this is an information economy, and it's going to collapse because you cannot create wealth with mere information, where services take the place of goods, where class warfare is useless and outdated. When you try to do this, other realities of true life no longer have any meaning. For example, you don't have a kin group anymore. No one's interested in having children, and the family unit's being destroyed, and that's on purpose. Plus, you can't have true community when your community is designed by suburban planners and neutered by civil rights laws. And you can't have a culture where you cannot even have a social club, because the government comes in and vetoes your ability to meet and freely assemble because you're discriminating. So today, the vast majority of people out there live their lives out in front of screens. Now, the big ones we call TV, and you stream all sorts of propaganda. The medium-sized ones are called PCs, and you do all sorts of research on there. And the small ones, they're known as tablets, and the miniature ones called smartphones or the black mirrors. Now, their most important social interactions, people in general, it's all happening on these screens, not in reality. So play and recreation that used to be done in playgrounds and in the field, They're now being done on video screens while gaming. Political life doesn't take place at the local fire hall anymore, folks. No, but by blathering on Twitter. And for the legion of porn consumers out there, consumers of the Sabbatean-produced pornography, and I did an entire show on this, folks, their sexual impulses have been reduced to nothing more than masturbation and so forth. I'm sorry for being profound here or profane, but they've turned sex into nothing more than pleasure. And that's not what it is, folks. So from the chat room to the video game to the porn site, they're all fake places, and that's what you have to remember. Created and maintained by these legion of nerds paid for by the Sabbateans, manipulating your reality and your desires. And as AI grows stronger and stronger in power, like we heard Nancy and Matthew read that preface from Nesta Webster's book, the human race becomes less dependent upon people. So a smaller and smaller group of people are controlling the basic levels of society. And this is getting more and more concentrated year by year. So these Sabbatean objectives go hand in hand with the triumph of the notional or the metaverse over the real. Now, it's always been intrinsic to Marxist ideology to eradicate the real and replace it with the notional. That's why they tear down statues, confuse gender, destroy marriages, family, and God. By doing so, they shift the power to the perverts and men without chests, as C.S. Lewis called them, those whose immorality control and regulate the notional, the false reality, the reality where nation, race, and people once had concrete meaning to this metaverse where you can be anything you want. You can identify as a cat. You can identify as a snail if you want. And it's diluting reality, Chenaries. Now, why wouldn't this be the case if you believe wrongly that true freedom can be achieved on a computer screen behind an avatar? Like I said, the same process is occurring in every element of our life, including biological sex. You know, the truth is that God's word is true, and God's word defines reality, as does science, true science, and genetics. But in this crazy upside-down world, sexual function and intimacy has been reduced to nothing more than masturbating to porn, a metaverse in which one's sexuality is determined by whatever scene they're into in this perverse world of pornography. In fact, even biological health is now being treated as a notional thing. And that's why racism and sexism are now components of the public health crisis that's affecting the world. That's why the CDC can recommend treatments like gender transitioning and all these puberty blockers. Not because it has any actual help with biological health, but because public health may suffer in the alternative and upside-down reality they've created, folks. So as this continues, as this whole world goes upside down and more notional things are foisted upon us as reality, digital figments of our imagination, so to speak, the idiots and the cucks will babble about spirituality and Gnosticism, which they don't even understand in the least bit, as they attempt to develop knowledge and practice things outside the digital sphere of their reality. They're so clueless, folks. They don't even understand that the source of all truth is the Word made flesh, Jesus Christ. And when you talk to some of them, you can see that they're trying to get out of this prison they're in, this metaverse, but they don't know where to turn. So for all the ugly, perverted freaks out there who are vying to be part of this metaverse ruling class, this idea that there's something out beyond this nominal world is just so alien to them. But it's very real, and it's very important in the genuine truth movement. So bodybuilding is a real activity. So, you know, strain to gain. There's no pain, no gain, you know? and the Brotherhood of Man still holds the promise of real social engagement. But nothing is more real than taking a wife and raising a family. When you're in that position, and I see my friend Ethan up at the plant realizing this, 28-year-old man realizing that this is the human condition, and this is what generations for millennia before him had to endure. These things and understanding of these truths will be sufficient to affect political and personal change in a proper manner. Now, when truthers talk about moving to rural areas and the prospects of divorcing the national narrative, so to speak, they are addressing real concerns, not simply AJ's info war. You know, it's more than just that, folks. It requires action. And what more action can you take than pouring your life and your wealth into raising a family? So it's no doubt you should leave the cities. But I'm telling you, these institutions that we've grown to love out in rural America and small town America, they are falling apart. And it's good to go to church rather than being online in some sort of, you know, meta church. But we have to go further. We have to rebuild our churches. Let them be built on lies, folks. And that's the point here. We need concrete versus ideological. We need men with hearts. We need men and women who know how to work on a car and to put up food and canning. We need people that understand what creates community. So the goal isn't to score merely intellectual victories on your Twitter thread, but to reorient the use of technology towards the establishment of real, true culture and society. You know, some rapper talking about Hitler may shift the Overton window, but unless we take true action, it's meaningless. And in the end, you'll still be ruled by these twink perverts pounding jungle beats into your ear till your dying day. And in the end, we'll all just have a bunch of sexual fetishes making gas chamber jokes before they molest our children and groom them. You know, folks, it's sad, but it's true. I think a better life wouldn't be had than raising a family and living off the land. Now, I have to keep moving because I looked at the clock and it's getting late. And it's time for our Hopium Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hopium Report, where dreamers of all sorts come for their faith snort. Prepared to get high on Hopium.
Now, this next one, you know, the two-day court hearing Carrie Lake had in Maricopa County has just concluded, and it was a historic election contest. And her trial included bombshell testimony from cybersecurity expert Clay Parkey, election investigator Heather Honey, Maricopa County whistleblower, the RNC roving attorney Mark Donnickler, County Recorder Stephen Riker, and Election Director Scott Jarrett were called to the stand and cross-examined. And on day two, the Arizona Elections Director Scott Jarrett admitted in court that the printer settings in the voting centers were switched on election day. This is corruption, folks, and this caused the ballots not to process. And tens of thousands of Republican Arizona voters were disenfranchised. You know, over 72% of the election day voters were Republican, and one out of three ballots were corrupted. And this election was lost by a couple thousand votes. So not even talking about all the other scandal, ballot harvesting and that. Carrie Lake won. And listen to her two-minute press release after the second day of the trial.
I'm just going to make a quick statement. I am so incredibly proud of our amazing attorneys and staff that put this amazing case together, historic case. We proved without a shadow of a doubt that there was malicious intent that caused disruption so great it changed the results of the election. I'm incredibly proud of both Brian Blem and Kurt Olson, who led up this legal team. We provided expert testimony. We provided experts. The other side brought in activists to try to save face. They admitted that they've known about these ballot problems. They're ballot problems. Now they're trying to say that it's been going on for three elections. Our elections are a mess in this country. And I am so happy to stand up and say, no longer will we as Americans put up with this. We demand fair, honest, transparent elections, and we will get them. And I pray so hard for this judge. I think that he really took in all of that information. I think he listened very closely to what happened. And I am fighting for the people of Arizona, but not just for the people of Arizona. I'm fighting for the people of this country and for our future. If we don't have honest elections where we decide who represents us, then we don't have a country anymore. And you know, the defendants, their attorney said it in his closing statement. He said, we choose our rulers. Isn't that telling? This was a selection, not an election. And we in America choose who represents us. And we will restore honest elections. And I will never stop fighting. I will never stop fighting. So thank you.
Folks, they violated state election laws. Yet here's how the mainstream media is reporting on all this going on in Arizona. So the feds, they have no say in this. This is a violation of Arizona state election law. Arizona has the right to prosecute this. In fact, they can even prosecute the feds if they try to step in and interfere. Now, fixing this must also include fixing the Republican state attorney general election as well. Did you know that he's only behind by 500 votes? Even after they pulled this sabotage and changed the printer settings and destroyed literally tens of thousands of Republicans' ability to vote. And a lot of people say, well, they're never going to reverse a gubernatorial race. Well, it happened before. In fact, it happened back in 1917 after Democrat George actually in office for over a year. And it involved some election ballot discrepancies. And in the end, Governor Edward Campbell, Republican, was declared the winner. But the fraud, George Hunt, actually served as the Democratic governor for an entire year. But you know what, folks? I have to keep moving. And right now, it's time for the Absurdian Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of the absurd. This is the Absurdium Report.
Life mimics theater, but fiction is safer. The curtain rises. The show begins.
Now, these Sabbateans, the COVIDians, they're actually calling us killers now. So you talk about cuckoo, folks. This one is sheer lunacy. But in this next clip, we have Peter Hotz, professor and dean, and a member of the UN Global Health Task Force, make this next statement. Anti-vaccine activism, which I actually call anti-science aggression, has now become a major killing force globally. These are his words, folks, not mine. And these COVIDians are calling us truth seekers, conspiracy theorists. You know, a conspiracy theory shelf life now is about a day, if even it makes 24 hours before it's proven to be conspiracy fact. But just have a listen to this one-minute clip, Peter Hotz.
professor and dean and member of the deep state, you know, the UN World Economic Forum COVIDians, calling you and me, people who stand on truth and stand in the light of truth, killers.
We have to recognize that anti-vaccine activism, which I actually call anti-science aggression, has now become a major killing force globally. During the COVID pandemic in the United States, 200,000 Americans needlessly lost their lives because they refused a COVID vaccine, even after vaccines became widely available. And now the anti-vaccine activism is expanding across the world, even into low and middle income countries. It's a killing force. Anti-science now kills more people than things like gun violence, global terrorism, nuclear proliferation, or cyber attacks. And now it's become a political movement. In the U.S., it's linked to far extremism on the far right, same in Germany. So this is a new face of anti-science aggression. And so we need political solutions to address this.
So are you seeing this common theme here, folks, from what Tim Robbins said to what Solomon from the Red Menace clips we played said? You know, you're labeled, you're disparaged. How about from the preface from Nesta Webster? Just slander them. Call them crazy. You know, this all reminds me of a scripture out of Revelation, chapter 18, verse 23, I think it is. For thy merchants, and think of Pfizer, Moderna, and all that ilk, were the great men of the earth, for by their sorceries, you know, that's pharmakia, were all nations deceived. So we've seen a lot of these good memes during the scamdemic, you know. But the best one I can remember said, if your vaccine works, why do I need one? If your vaccine doesn't work, why do I need one? Now, let's do some critical thinking here, folks. If your dog was vaccinated against rabies three times, yet it still got rabies, would that be a major concern of yours concerning the efficacy of the rabies vaccine? Well, of course it would be. So then why are these people still getting boosted over and over again and still getting COVID and then blaming us? Folks, this isn't rocket science. There are countless people who have been multiple jabbed and boosted so many times that they're losing count, and yet they still get COVID. So what does science have to say about the effectiveness of the jab? You know, the whole purpose of science is to question everything, assume nothing, and accept no absolutes. So as soon as I heard that we're not allowed to question it, I knew there was no science involved in that scam. And you can wind the clock all the way back to the beginning of 2020 when I started these updates and changed the format of SDG. Folks, this isn't science that I'm standing against. This is scientism, which is a religion, the religion of the left. And when you say something against their scientism, they call you anti-science, but what they're actually saying is that you're a blasphemer to their religion. Let's have a re-listen to what Tim Robbins dropped at the end of that interview with Russell Brand.
It's not good. We turned into tribal, angry, vengeful people. And I don't think that's something that is sustainable for the earth, that we start demonizing people that don't agree with our particular health policies and turn them into monsters, turn them into pariahs, say that they don't deserve a hospital bed. I think about, you know, people that have made bad mistakes in their lives where they take too many drugs and they overdose. And that's totally their choice. That's totally their responsibility. Yet we take care of them. Yet we bring them to the hospital. Yet we save their lives because we're compassionate, because we want to make sure that people live. And this turned. It turned into you should fucking die because you have not complied. That's incredibly dangerous.
It is dangerous, folks. I have to keep moving. It's time for Ken's Corner, spelled with a K.
Welcome to Ken's Corner, spelled with a K, where I'll share my life experiences to help you understand what's going on in this crazy, crazy world. So let's get started.
Now, folks, when I was a young guy years ago, I was both bold and fearless, and I was also a bit brash. I'd charge headlong into with little understanding of the cost in time or money, and I never even considered personal risk. But praise the Lord, folks, through it all, God was there, and His grace was sufficient. And then as I lived life, I became wiser, and with that wisdom came caution. But I noticed that caution could easily turn into fear, fear of the unknown, fear of failing, fear of even beginning to build that tower that I couldn't finish. And it reminded me of something Isaiah wrote in chapter 7, verse 9, the second part of that verse where God, speaking through the prophet Isaiah, says, "If we will not believe or have faith, surely we shall not be established or stand firm." And all I can say to that, folks, is amen. And that's the key, having faith or remaining faithful to the promises of God, regardless of your phase in life, regardless of your circumstances in life. But each and every day, with each and every step in this journey called life, have faith, or surely you shall not be established. So by doing so, we will be established and remain standing firm, regardless of what this life may throw at us. So I encourage you, folks, stand. And then when you're done standing, stand some more. And the only thing stable enough to stand upon is the Word of God. I have to keep moving, and right now it's time for Back to the Future. The segment where we take something from the past and bring it back to the future. And today, folks, we're going to wind the clock back, way back to 1666. That's a long time ago, folks. And back in 1666, most of the world thought the Messiah was about to return or come for the first time if you're a Jew. And in the 1700s, the Kabbalah and the Talmud, specifically the Laurian Kabbalah, out of which Sabbatai Zevi was a follower, started to gain momentum. And what I'd like to do is introduce you to this man named Sabbatai Levi, or Sabbatai Zevi, I should say. And here's a 6 minute and 51 second clip titled Sabbatai Zevi, the Messiah Who Almost Brought Down Judaism. And this is the key, folks, to everything you're seeing today with these secret societies and subversive movements. But it didn't start here. It goes further back, like we heard Solomon say, clear back to the ancients, clear back to that murder where Cain killed Abel, where man's will superseded God's will. Let's have a listen.
The 17th century was a time when practically everyone in Europe and the Middle East was expecting the Messiah to come. There's a mass messianic hysteria with people prophesizing in crowds in public. You needed just one spark for the entire powder keg to blow. And that is what happened with Shabtai Tzvi. In Smyrna, as a teenager, he began toying with practical Kabbalistic ideas, challenging his rabbis, and starts wondering, am I the Messiah? The Jewish authorities there don't love this, so they kick him out of his hometown, and he starts traveling from city to city, sometimes making an impact, sometimes getting banished, sometimes both. He ends up in Jerusalem. Now, at the time, it was a poor, tiny community, and they loved him there. He was charismatic, and he had a beautiful voice. He was quite possibly the first person to set Jewish songs to the melodies of other cultures, and we're not just talking Adon Olam here. They gave him the high honor of raising money for the Jerusalem Jewish community. So he starts regularly moving between Cairo and Jerusalem. Once, on his way back, he stops by Nathan of Gaza, who's an important Kabbalist. Shabtai tells him about his swinging mood changes and that he wants help correcting his soul, what practical Kabbalists were known for. Nathan of Gaza quickly comprehends that the numeric value of the letters composing Shabtai's full name is the same as several messianic references in the Bible and says, "Sorry, you don't need correcting, because you are the Messiah." Shabtai loves this idea, and together they head to Jerusalem, and there, in public, he declares himself as the Messiah. "We're going to make a fast day, the 9th of Av, a time for feasting. Why mourn? We're just on the verge of rebuilding the temple." Some were turned off, but many people started believing him. So, why? Here's the main theory. In Jerusalem in 1665, they likely weren't aware of the Khmelnytskyi massacre, where 8 years previous, an estimated 100,000 Jews were killed in Ukraine. So, it probably wasn't looking for a person to give them hope following that. And it also most likely wasn't due to the influence of Lurianic Kabbalah, as that branch of Kabbalism didn't become widely popular until a bit later. Rather, it was simply the ubiquitous messianic fervor in the culture at that time. People deeply believed the messianic age was coming. Shabtai offered hope, saying, "We'll reconquer the land of Israel and redistribute it among the resurrected 10 tribes. And Nathan writes many, many Jewish communities, spreading the word. The Ottoman Sultan gets heebie-jeebies of the reports of what's going on and has Shabtai come to Istanbul. So if this guy is the Messiah, he's on his side. And if he's not, then he'll shut him down to keep the peace in the empire. Riding in on a horse with a saber on his side, notably two acts prohibited to Jews and all dhimmis at that time, he enters the city and is surrounded by hundreds of people, confident that he's the Messiah. At this time, in 1666, we have heavy evidence that most of Jews in the diaspora, from Yemen to Amsterdam, are believers in Shabtai Tzvi. Synagogues had prayers for him. His picture was printed next to King David's in many prayer books, with an inscription, "Save our people." And Jews who opposed him said, "We are living in messianic times, but Shabtai Tzvi is not the Messiah." But they couldn't say this out loud, as they'd be beaten. Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews had a similar response. Sabbatianism helped unite the diaspora, showing that both sides had the same issues and expectations, and the same messianic craze. These were Jewish communities that had never spoken to each other before. So the Sultan calls him in and says, "People say you're the Messiah, which means you're immortal." Shabtai says, "Maybe, maybe not. So let me do this," says the Sultan. "I'll have my archers hit you with their arrows. If you die, so be it. You're an imposter. But if you don't, you are the Messiah and I'll bow down to you." Shabtai apparently says, "Is there an alternative?" And the alternative is converting to Islam. We don't know exactly what happened, but Shabtai leaves the palace proudly wearing a fez, having converted. Now, Nathan of Gaza doesn't let a little thing like their Messiah switching religions stop the movement. He gets ahead of it and writes letters across the diaspora saying Shabtai is still the Messiah. "The function of the Messiah is to redeem holy sparks throughout the world, and only the Messiah can go to the dark side, Islam," the 1660s were a bit less PC than now, "to redeem sparks from even there." Most Jews don't buy this. They're shocked and wondered how they can atone for the sin of believing in him. They fast and do self-flagellation. And they remove evidence of him having been such a big deal from the histories, reframing it as just some crazy blip. But others consider his conversion a martyrdom of sorts. What he taught is now more true than ever because he willingly sacrificed himself. After he converts, Shabtai lives in a Turkish palace under house arrest with his disciples by his side, and people from all over the diaspora flock to him, their Messiah. Despite converting, he still sang Jewish songs, ate kosher, and celebrated the holidays, declaring it was Shabbat on whatever day of the week he saw as fit. Some followed him in converting to Islam, the Danma. They secretly practiced Jewish traditions within Islam. This group lasted for hundreds of years. In the 1920s, they numbered 15,000. And in 1676, 10 years after he converted, Shabtai died. His disciples kept spreading the idea of Sabbatianism, leading to a line of messianic figures to follow. But the rest of the Jewish world, most Jews, needed to do something with the Kabbalistic legacy he used and abused. There was a search for how to follow Kabbalah properly now. And 100 years later, Hasidic Judaism would provide that answer. It came not necessarily to get rid of the messianic ideas in Kabbalah, but rather to interpret them in a completely different, more kosher light. To learn how and why Hasidic Judaism began, changing the face of Judaism with it, watch the next video in this series. Make sure to subscribe for when future videos come out, and if you're interested in supporting me making more videos like this one, please click the link below in the video description. Thank you for watching.
Now, this was a mainstream normie storyline. So it had truth in it, but it was tempered with lies, or it had lies tempered with truth, depending upon your perspective. One manner of truth is he clearly identified the man. One lie was he minimized the impact of the Kabbalah, Talmud, on this man's teaching. And he also minimized the influence Sabbateans have today. The truth was that he mentioned the Ashkenazis and the Sephardic Jews, but the lie is he didn't explain the difference. So that was a lie by omission. Let's go a little deeper, and let's listen to this clip from J.P. Watson and James Dellingpole. I'm sorry, is this it? No, it's we're going to talk with James and Michael Obernicia on the Sabbatean Frankists, and you're going to get a little more truth here. Let's have a listen to this.
Every institution in the world has been suborned partly by woke culture, but partly by what you and I recognize as the forces that really run the world. You might call them the powers that be, that there are higher entities which are hell-bent, and I use that phrase quite deliberately, on destroying everything of value in our culture, everything that we hold dear, because they despise us. And this process of attrition has been going on for decades, if not centuries. But now we are really witnessing it in excelsis. It's just accelerated. It's intensified. Would you agree with that?
100%. And it can also be described, this cult, this Babylonian nefarious cult of evildoers, it does have a name. Name is the Sabbatean Frankists. The Sabbatean Frankists were founded by Sabbatier Zivi in 1666. Sabbatier Zivi was a man who proclaimed that he was the foretold Jewish Messiah, only that his reign over the Jews, as he described, was entirely predicated on his conviction and that of his disciples, that the purpose of his life was to bring about an inversion of good and evil. In other words, to turn evil into good and good into evil so that no one can tell the difference anymore. And in his mad ramblings, he dictated that everybody must follow this creed to use deception or inversion against all their enemies, and all of their enemies constituted everybody who wasn't in the cult. Now, the reason I know this is because prior to 1981, there was an awful lot of material around about on this subject, because it links directly to the Rothschild cartel, because there is much evidence around to say that the Rothschilds are the same bloodline as Sabbatier Zivi. And another man who lived in the 18th century called Jacob Frank in Frankfurt. Now, Jacob Frank in Frankfurt was one of the three people, along with Amschel Rothschild and the Adam Weishaupt. They founded the Bavarian Illuminati around about 1770. Now, when this happened, it was a complete secret. And what they did was they created a pact, and the pact was that they would take control of every surviving royal bloodline and every one of the major religions, and they would take control from within in order to subvert it according to Sabbatai Zevi's doctrine. And to hide Sabbatai Zevi, they started calling it Frankism, and that's what it became known as. And then it developed into the Frankfurt School. What did the Frankfurt School invent? Every leftist ideology, every rightist ideology, and they created the false left-right paradigm. Because the truth is, fascism and communism are virtually identical. But they have one thing above all others in common, and that is that the banker's power remains in place, but is used more aggressively. That's the major difference. Planned economy, complete control of everyone's lives.
Shazam.
That's right, Gomer. Shazam. So he turned it upside down. The Sabbatean turned it upside down, just as Isaiah said, making good evil and evil good. So this is straight out of the Sabbatean doctrine that today is known as rules for radicals, calling good evil and evil good. So how do we apply it to what's going on today? Well, this week in London Rail with Mr. Rose, he featured none other than David Icke. Now, whatever you think of David Icke, that's fine. But in this episode we're going to play here, and I'm running this over, and I may run out of time, but it's so important that we expose the Sabbateans. In this episode, we have David Icke talk about the controlled opposition known as Donald Trump.
Tell me about politics, because we had the Trust Show here for a few weeks. Now it's Rishi Sunak, and also in America, we've got an election coming up in 2 years. With two Republicans that are going to try to kill each other on the way to that election. What do you see in both situations?
Well, as I said about Trump before he got elected in 2016, he's being brought in, whether he knows it or not, to divide America. Because there's a guy called Saul Alinsky who is... It kind of was followed by people like Obama and Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi. And he wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. And it was how you take a democratic society, basically, and turn it into a communist one. And one of the things that he pointed out is that you don't target faceless corporations. You pick out one guy, and you target him. You blame him or her, in this case him, for everything. Because it's like the Nazis said, keep your propaganda simple. Don't make it complicated. Keep your propaganda simple. It's like the propaganda against me in the Netherlands. He's an anti-Semite. He's a Holocaust denier. End of story. Evidence? No, not necessary. Just keep saying it. And so Trump came in, and basically America was very quickly divided, because you had the Trump supporters, and then you had people who were vehemently anti-Trump, and you created this divide in America. And what they will be planning to do, if Trump goes the distance into the Republican nomination period, is they'll seek to do the same. They'll be targeting him as far right or anti-Semitic, as the last thing he is, by the way. And they'll go down that road. And then you have DeSantis. Now, DeSantis, I don't know a lot about as a person and his background, and I'll be very interested to see what that is. All I can do looking on is to look at what he's done in Florida, and he has done it whereas Trump has talked about it. And let's not forget, Trump had 4 years in the White House. So he pushed back on lockdown rules and segregation in Florida, to the point where it was a much more open society than much of the rest of America. He's pushed back through laws of sexualizing children in schools, which is massively part of this agenda. It's why they're bringing the drag queens out, to confuse gender in the young. What better way to confuse gender to have a bloke with a beard wearing a dress? I have no problem with drag queens, by the way. All the best. Do what you like, so long as you don't pose on anyone else. But that's what's happening. They're being used to confuse gender in the young for a much longer-term agenda that I've written about in the books for years. And he's also, through law in Florida, pushed back on the castration and mutilation of children, in the name of transgender surgery. So I look at, and you know, he's challenged a lot of things, literally challenged them, not just talked about it. So on that basis, my jury's out on him, because I don't know his background and all that yet, but certainly on the face of what he's done in Florida, he's done it while Trump's talked about it.
I'm looking for partners, collaborators.
So there you have it, folks. This is a Sabbatean doctrine of Ordo Ab Caeo. But it goes further back than the Sabbateans. And it goes further into the future through Frankism and the Frankfurt School and the false left-right paradigm. Now, this is a crazy world, and we all know that. So how do you find any peace in this world? How are we to love life in the midst of this world's chaos and confusion? Well, you know, the Bible says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, "For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile." So now it's time to switch gears and learn four simple steps. Simple, but like I said at the opening, not necessarily easy steps to love life in this lost and fallen world. Now here they are. 1, watch your mouth. 2, do good, not evil. 3, seek and pursue peace. Finally, 4, trust God as we all keep on praying. Like I said, they're four simple, yet not necessarily easy steps. Now, Peter references this term love 7 times in his epistles, 5 in the first letter and twice in the second book. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, he said, "For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile." So he wants us to love life and see good days. And who doesn't want that? Well, of course we all do. Question from St. Peter. Yet so many of us see bad days and react in ways that have our lives spiral out of control. And that's exactly what the Sabbateans want, folks. So although Peter's solutions to this dilemma may be easy, the application is difficult. Think about all those sales pitches we hear all the time, you know, about weight loss and hair growth. And, you know, instant riches. You know, they all may sound good. Most of those aren't true. But this that we're talking about today, grounded in the promises from God. So it's not a sales pitch, but it's a rock-ribbed promise from Jehovah Elohim. So who doesn't want to live life and eliminate hardship? Who doesn't want a stress-free life? We all do, but these are ideals, not reality. The truth is that we're all going to suffer hardship in life. And Peter gives us the logic to understand this irony. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 through 24, he says, "For what glory is it if when ye are buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently?" So if you do something wrong, expect to face the music, so to speak. And that's nothing but to be expected. But if you do well and suffer for it patiently, This is honorable. This is acceptable to God. But why does this happen? And why did God put this in the Bible? Well, right here, Peter's telling us that just as Jesus suffered, we're going to suffer. In verse 21, he says, "For even hereunto ye are called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, being dead to sins, could live in righteousness, by whose stripes ye were healed." So a life loved isn't necessarily a life that's free of trouble. And the same applies to money, folks. You know, Jesus said in Mark chapter 8, verses 36 and 37, "For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" And then Peter continues over in chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. "For he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile. Let him eschew evil and do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil." So in those three verses, Peter gives us those four steps crucial to loving life. Number one, he said, watch your mouth. Number two, he said, do good, not evil. Number three, he said, seek and pursue peace. Number four, trust God and keep on praying. Now, like I said, these are simple truths, easier said than done. And one of the reasons we struggle is because our minds aren't focused properly. So in other words, we have to live our lives focused, laser focused on Jesus. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9 read, "Finally, be ye all of one mind, having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrary wise, blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. So when harmed, bless. When hurt by others, bless." That's simple, but difficult. Because the first impulse is to lash out with your tongue. James tells us in 3 verse 6 that the tongue's like a fire. And then St. Paul said in Romans chapter 7 verse 21, "I find then a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me." Bottom line, folks, though, is that by the grace of God, we can prevail. James said that faith without works is dead. So although grace gives you and me the ability to obey, it also requires initiative. Nothing happens by accident. So can you make it? Not on your own, but by the grace of God you will. When you embrace these truths found in the scripture and realize that you can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. You also have to love gain from good and avoid gain from wrongdoing. And bottom line, we have to love one another. Peter said in chapter 4, verse 8, "Above all things, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity or love shall cover the multitude of sins." You know, the truth is, folks, that it's pretty hard to love your life without loving the people in it. And sometimes that's really tough to do. God will empower you. So, folks, I haven't wished you Merry Christmas yet. So Merry Christmas to all of you and your family. And in the words of Winston Churchill, never give up. Never, no, never. Now, I'm not going to play that because we don't have time. But I am going to play Mary, Did You Know? In honor of this high and holy day when Jesus humbled himself and became flesh. I love you all.
your baby boy would save our sons and daughters. Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? This child that you delivered.